Welcome to the New Books in Sports podcast. My name is Bob D'Angelo, and I'm working on my master's degree in history at Southern New Hampshire University. Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Adam J. Cribley, author of the book Tall Tales and Short Shorts, Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the Birth of the Modern NBA. Hope you enjoy the interview. Welcome back to the New Books in Sports podcast. Our guest today is Dr. Adam J. Cribley, the author of Tall Tales and Short Shorts, Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the Birth of the Modern NBA. Adam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Great. Adam is the director for the Center for Regional History and an assistant professor of history at Southeast Missouri State University in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, the home of the Red Hawks. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your background, academically and otherwise.
Sure. So I got my PhD from Purdue University in 2008. And from there, a couple of adjunct teaching positions later, ended up at Southeast Missouri State and am starting my sixth academic year at Southeast Missouri State. This book is actually my second book that I've had published. The first, though, was about the 19th century and Independence Day celebrations in the urban Midwest. So really, read by about six people, including my parents. And so it's been nice to have written and talk about it a little bit. Might have a little bit more readership here.
Very true. Talk about the perception of pro basketball during the 1970s. In the 1960s, you had the Celtics dynasty. And then in the 80s, you had Magic Johnson and Larry Bird coming to ascendance. And then, you had Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant, now LeBron James. David Stern made the comment that the 1970s were the dark ages of the NBA, which you quoted in the book. Do you feel like they were the dark ages back then?
I do think that they were. There's a perception that they were the dark ages. I think that the 1960s were clearly a golden age of pro basketball. You had the Celtics dynasty, of course, that got all the headlines. You had famous moments like Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game, Oscar Robertson averaging a triple-double. And so there are these iconic, kind of bigger-than-life, almost mythical elements of the 1960s. And then in the 1980s, you have what people kind of dubbed the saving of the NBA with Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, and of course later Michael Jordan. And so I think if you, at first glance or at first blush, it does look like really dark days in the NBA in the 1970s. And when I went into the project, honestly, that was what I was expecting, was a very negative kind of the downturn of the NBA. And what I saw instead was that there was no one transcendent team. There was maybe not even the one or two transcendent players. There certainly were some very good players. And I would argue that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the 1970s had as dominant a decade as any player in NBA history. But that really it was that lack of identifiable superstar, the marketable team or player. And so there is this perception that it was the dark days. But I think if you read the book or if you at least study it a little deeper, you'll realize that there's a lot more there than just kind of that blank. It was a down decade kind of narrative.
Yeah, definitely. It was like they almost got no respect.
Absolutely, yeah. The Rodney Dangerfield of decades, right?
Well, I mean, you write in your book as an example, Portland wins the NBA title in 1977 and CBS immediately switches to the Kemper Open golf tournament.
Sure, yeah. That's a pretty bad sign, right? And the city of Portland celebrated and had a tremendous time of that celebration, but yeah, most viewers missed it. And so the NBA was definitely not on the same level as, for example, professional football at the time, or even really Major League Baseball, and was very much seen as kind of the lesser of American sports in that decade. And in fact, a lot of times it even overshadowed by major boxing matches. And so it was certainly not the media darling or the entertainment industry it is today.
Yeah. Also, I think you also put and I almost laughed when I read this, is like the Indiana Pacers needed a telethon to raise money.
Yeah, that was a great story and one that I didn't know about. And actually, I was writing that chapter when I believe it was a 30 for 30 short or something about it came out. And so I just had to laugh because it was stuff that I was researching at the time. And to see how absurd that sounds in 2017, it's pretty amazing how far the league's come.
Very definitely. What else did during your research did that surprised you as you combed through all this information?
Well, I think one thing that really surprised me was I come to this as a modern fan. I wasn't around for most of the 1970s to watch this game. And so it surprised me really how quality the game was, because you hear so many of the narratives about the old timers saying how great the game was and it's not good now. It's just such a different style of play that I really grew to enjoy and embrace the 1970s style that was up and down, fast paced, but also a lot of mid-range jump shots, a lot of really skilled players that I was kind of surprised again by the level of play and how much I really enjoyed it. So that broadly was something I really came to take away from researching the NBA in the 70s.
Plus, they didn't even have the 3-point shot in the NBA.
Right. Yeah. So there was no real incentive to shoot the ball from 25 feet.
Right. Although when Jerry West made that 60-foot shot in the playoffs, that would have probably won the game for them.
It would have. Yeah. And in fact, it's funny that there are later instances. So that was a long 2-pointer, 60-foot 2-pointer. There was another instance, and I'm blanking on the year right now, but somebody banked in a 60-footer and they just assumed it was overtime. Well, it was actually worth 3 points and they'd won. So it took some adjustment once the NBA adopted the 3-point shot to kind of get used to playing with it.
Right. You said you followed basketball more recently. Do you have any kind of background in basketball other than the fan? Did you play or did you root or what was your love with basketball?
Mm-hmm. All of the above. So I started playing basketball when I was probably 8 years old. I was able to play through 3 years in college. I went to a Division III school. So when I tell my students that, they always, seem really impressed, but I wasn't on an academic scholarship or anything. And so I was able to play Division III basketball at Ohio Wesleyan University. And that, it gave me a great appreciation for what student athletes do and the hours that they put into that, their trade in college with that. And also, of course, it continued my love of basketball. And so I was really into college basketball and not only playing, but watching at that point. And then I kind of took a hiatus, and really from about 2004 or so, the Malice in the Palace was kind of turned me off. I was a Pacers fan, or am a Pacers fan, until about 2012 or so. I didn't pay a lot of attention to the game.
What position did you play when you played basketball?
Is bench a position? Because I played a lot of that. In high school I played power forward, and in college I played power forward as well, but there's not a lot of call for a 6-foot-4, not incredibly athletic power forward at any level, Division III or otherwise. So my fondest college basketball moment was when I was in practice and one of our assistant coach, we were running out of bounds plays, and one of the assistant coaches turned to me and asked me how. He's like, "Where's the 3-man go on this play," or something like that. And I knew, and I remembered that. So, that was probably the highlight, was that I knew the plays better than the coaches sometimes. But yeah, as far as on the court, I played a lot of forward, but mostly rode the pine in college.
Understood. Your first book, as you noted, was more about history. It was called Parading Patriotism, Independence Days in the Urban Midwest, 1826 to 1876. Now, obviously, anytime you write a book, there's research involved. I'm sure there was a different kind of approach for each book. Could you compare your methods going into it, or were they pretty much the same?
Well, they were a lot different. I learned a lot from writing the first book, and the first book was a doctoral dissertation turned into a book. And I really was kind of new to research at that point, at least at that level. So I did a lot of newspaper research. I did a lot of research in different archives. And so in that way, I guess, the basketball project was similar. I did go to travel to some archives, and I did definitely use microfilm and other newspaper sources. But one big change in even that 5 or 6 year period between book number one, writing that, and book number two, is just how many sources are now available on the internet. And so being able to do a lot of research from the comfort of my office definitely made book number two easier to research. Although the downside of that was that, so my first draft of the book was 146,000 words, and I ended up cutting almost 50,000 for the final draft. So I overwrote. There was a lot of information that just couldn't make it into the book, but that's a good problem to have.
That is a good problem. You'd rather have more than less, that's for sure. Now, in the 1970s, you know, regardless of what people might think now, they had some very colorful personalities. You had Pete Maravich, you know, Dr. J, Rick Barry, and as you said, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Earl the Pearl Monroe. Talk about some of these guys. What made them such colorful, dominant figures?
Well, I think a lot of it is that we think of today, you know, today's media athletes, or today's athletes, I should say, have grown up in an age of social media, and they're very, many of them are very cognizant of their brand, of their public persona, of their image. And in the 1970s, you had a lot less of that. Basketball wasn't nearly covered to the extent that it is today. And so a lot of times players were a little bit more unfiltered. And so you get to see more of their character come out. If you think about maybe a player like LeBron James today, we know a lot about him. He's well covered. But in the 1970s, you didn't know a lot about those players unless they were very outspoken. And so Rick Barry is a great example. Rick Barry gave tremendous interviews in the 70s, and reporters flocked to him because they knew he would give them the truth. He would say exactly what was on his mind, even if it was controversial. And so some of those players, you really kind of get to know their personalities better because they're not worried about how they're going to be perceived. And players like Barry, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was notoriously kind of acerbic. He didn't give a lot of interviews. And when he did, he was pretty terse and short with reporters. But all those players, the top athletes of the decade, people got to know what they really felt as opposed to what they wanted to present.
Right. And Barry certainly didn't endear himself to other players with his outspokenness.
No, not at all.
And of course, you also mentioned in the book about Kareem, you know, everyone, he had this dour personality, but it sort of came out that he had a sense of humor when he had that part in Airplane where, you know, he tried to stay out of character and the kid kept pressing him.
Yep. No, and that's a classic moment. And if you talk to, or if you read about what players thought at the time when that came out, they were amazed that he had a personality. He just hadn't shown it. He'd gotten burnt a couple different times, and especially because of in the 1970s, being an African-American Muslim, especially when he was in Milwaukee, that was just so out of character in every way that he felt, I think, every time he would speak that his words would be turned around and he was misunderstood. And so he kind of pulled into his own shell. There was an incident that happened in, I believe, 1974 or 5, when his home in Washington, D.C., he was in Milwaukee at the time, but his home in Washington, D.C. was attacked. And many of his friends were killed in that attack. So he became even more guarded at that point. And so when he makes that cameo on Airplane, or has the big role in Airplane, it really shocks people to see that Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has a personality.
Almost as good as Barbara Billingsley. You know, it's interesting too, and you mentioned this in the book, is with Julius Erving and Pete Maravich. I mean, there was a possibility, and if it had gone through, it would have been very interesting that they both could have been on the same squad in Atlanta. Do you think those two guys could have coexisted?
Oh, absolutely. I think that it kind of reminds me of the, and again, just pulling some modern comparisons, kind of the Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook dynamic on the court, where you have two people that are very ball dominant, but in an ideal world, they both complement each other well. Pistol Pete loved to pass. Julius Erving was an unselfish player. And I think that, you know, you can only imagine the terror that would have gone into opponents' hearts if you have on a fast break a 2-on-1 with Pete coming down the left side and Dr. J on the right. I think at that point, you just get out of the way and can see the basket. So it would have been high flying. They would have definitely gotten gotten a lot of publicity for the NBA at that point, and you know, sadly, it just wasn't meant to be.
And you know, some of the features you did, where you do a year by year breakdown, which is really great, but you do the features on Maravich and Dr. J and the merger. What was it about Maravich that was so electrifying to the fans?
Well, I think that for many of those fans who hadn't seen Bob Cousy in his prime, Maravich was the first player that they can remember who played in a flashy style. He could make a simple bounce pass, but he would make it flashy. He would add a little flair, and he was a showman. And I think that from the guard position, there hadn't been that many of them in the NBA at that point. Obviously, you have players like Earl Monroe, who's flashy, and but Maravich even took that one step higher. Like I said, he was a good passer and was also often flashing his passes. So he added a level of excitement. And I think, you know, another thing I mentioned in the book is that he's a white player. And at the end, in the 1970s, the NBA becomes increasingly dominated by African-American athletes. And so, you know, for a fan in the 1970s, there's something to the idea that a fan wants to watch TV and see someone that they can identify with. And so for a white kid growing up in the 1970s to be able to watch Pete Maravich, maybe they're able to identify with him a little more than they are an African-American like Earl Monroe. So for a variety of reasons, I think that Maravich really captured the attention of the public. And he'd had almost a mythic career at LSU, averaging, you know, 44 points a game as a senior. And so there was almost this sense of watching him was an experience. Watching him was in itself kind of a form of entertainment.
And on the other hand, you had Irving that just seemed to like soar to the basket. I mean, he's a different type of excitement, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it's somewhat of the appeal that we see when Magic Johnson and Larry Bird come in the NBA in the 1980s with, you know, there's a white player and a black player. They're both exciting and flashy, but they do so in very different ways. So Maravich, actually, much like Johnson, isn't going to, you know, wow you with dunks or hyper athletic plays. And instead, he's going to beat you with crafty passes and be exciting. And Irving, and this is where it falls apart, Bird wasn't a dunker like Irving, but Irving, you know, swooping to the hoop and scoring. And he was one of those players that he would throw down a dunk and fans would stand up, and really without even realizing they were doing so, he just brought fans out of their seats, really like no athlete had at that point. And the only other player I think that you can compare him to is a young Elgin Baylor, as far as the athleticism and his body control that Irving displayed.
Definitely. And when we talk about Irving, we have to mention the ABA. I mean, that was certainly a very different type of league with some different rules and different style of play. Could you compare the two leagues and the players that they had?
By 1976, when the merger happens, they're very similar leagues, at least as far as talent is concerned. There's a huge talent disparity when the ABA first starts in 1967. The NBA clearly has better talent. The ABA catches up, though, and by about 1973 or 4, the talent's relatively equal between the two leagues. The style of play, however, is far different. So in the ABA, with a three-point line, obviously, you have players that are becoming outside shooting specialists. Their job is to basically sit on the perimeter and shoot long jump shots. The NBA, on the other hand, that's less of an emphasis. In the ABA, they are celebrating high-flying forwards. That's kind of where the ABA really excels. The NBA is still relying on the traditional dribble the ball down the court, throw it into the center who tries to make a post move. Maybe the point guard attacks the rim, but it was a much different pace, a much different style. The ABA was also less seen on TV, so there was an air of mystique around them that didn't exist as much in the NBA. And so for a variety of reasons, the leagues were very different. But as I said, by 1976, when the merger happens, the talent level in the ABA has basically reached parity with the NBA.
Definitely, definitely so. I remember living in South Florida, we had the Miami Floridians that first year, and they were, yeah, exactly, very nondescript, to be charitable. In the 1970s, there was this perception, you know, that I think even you have it in the book where David Stern said that the NBA was seen as this bunch of high salary drug sniffing black guys. I mean, was there that much of a cultural difference or perception in getting all types of fans to watch and enjoy this game?
So just to clarify, what Stern was saying was that there was a perception that was what the league was. He wasn't himself saying that was the issue, but there was a perception that was a problem. And the fan base at the time, you know, if you look in the stands, there were more white people than black people at NBA games. And so Stern was concerned, and many others, both owners and players and other fans, they weren't concerned necessarily the fact that a lot of players were African-American, was certainly something that that several owners actually are outspoken about, the fact that they needed more white players. But even the less racist overtones were that the perception was very negative, that the league had a higher percentage of African Americans, that the athletes were perceived to be overpaid. There's a report in 1980 that 75% of athletes are using cocaine in the NBA. And there's on-court violence. In 1978, you have the very famous punch in which Rudy Tomjanovich is almost killed on a basketball court. And so for a variety of reasons, you have this perception that the league is too black, the league is too violent, the league is the players are spoiled, rich guys. And this is all kind of coming to head at the same time, that there is no singular star other than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar that can really take that, that can really gain that interest in the game. So Julius Erving actually has kind of a rough patch in the late 70s, and people really question whether he still has it. Pete Maravich blows out his knee. He's basically done by 1978, 79. And so by late in the decade, no one's watching the Washington Bullets and Seattle Supersonics playing back-to-back finals in 78 and 79. The national narrative, no one cares. And so that, I think, is a lot. All this stuff coming together really leads to a negative perception of the league just at the moment that Bird and Johnson enter in 1980.
And you did reference the Kermit Washington punch. And in fact, John Feinstein did an entire book on one punch, which was amazing. Violence definitely was an issue. Was there any more violence on the court in the 70s than previously, or even now? I mean, we had some very bad incidents since then, but that one just seems to have been like a crystallizing moment in NBA history.
Well, I think a lot of it was that obviously the punch is a singular event that draws a lot of negative media attention to the game, but that also follows on the heel of Sports Illustrated publishing an entire the front page article that's titled The Enforcers. And the article really seems to celebrate violence in basketball and that every team has this enforcer on it. So I think that that coupled with, there's also very famous at the time incident in the 1977 finals where you have two player from each team, Maurice Lucas and Daryl Dawkins, kind of square off old style, put up your dukes and throw punches at each other in the finals. And so there is a lot of violence in the 1970s. There also is a lot of violence in the NBA, really since its inception. And it was a terribly violent sport in the 1930s and 40s and into the 50s and 60s. In the 1970s, increased media coverage, the punch, those sorts of things really play up to that narrative. The NBA remained violent throughout the 1980s, never to the extent of the punch. But there's a very famous Dr. J and Larry Bird fight, and that's just the most celebrated maybe. But that violence really continues, I would argue, through the, and I've seen it argued elsewhere, through the Ewing-era Knicks of the 90s, before it really starts to die down, only to be ignited again in 2004 with the Malice in the Palace.
Right. That was perfect nickname and plenty of turmoil for that one. How do you think pro basketball reflected America's culture of the 1970s? Is there a cultural angle that you were trying to achieve in this book? I mean, I know you threw in some references. The one I liked was the Ray Stevens, the wrestler reference. That was sure. A lot of fun. To read that.
No, there was. So the, my goal in writing the book was both to talk about the NBA in the 70s and also to put it in the context of its decade. And so some of the players and some of the teams and the way that the game functioned was in many ways a reflection of what's going on culturally and nationally. To me, a very powerful moment was the day after the Kent State shootings in 1970, the New York Knicks played against the Los Angeles Lakers and in the NBA Finals. And there were players in the upper deck, there were fans in the upper deck at Madison Square Garden who were sitting during the national anthem. Apparently there was kind of a blue haze of pot smoke up there. And to think that, that's happening at the same time and somewhat in response to these larger national issues really caught my attention. And so there are a lot of kind of fun cultural references in there that hopefully people will enjoy and pick up on. But I think there's also a thread of that reflection of culture on basketball and of basketball and culture. And to me, you know, as a historian, that was an important thing to pull out here as well.
Right, because you had the turmoil of Vietnam, you had Watergate, you had the fall of South Vietnam, and then toward the end of the decade, you had the Iran hostage crisis. So it was just
one thing after another. Yeah, just on top of everything. So,
do you think that 1970s basketball, as more historians start digging into it, do you think that maybe it'll escape that Dark Ages label that you know, it's easy one to slap on it on a decade or era. We as Americans, we tend to label decades, you know, the decade of this or the decade of that. But do you think it could escape that and be looked at more critically now?
You know, I hope so. My fear, though, is that it's still, you know, NBA.com, for example, calls it a decade of parity in which there's no dominant team, no dominant player. And I think that that is a defining narrative. I really like, so the Dark Days analogy, I really like how there's it used to be a website, now a book called Free Darko. And Free Darko wrote a book about basketball history, looking at really a span of history. And I like the argument they make. They say the NBA is not a Dark Ages. Instead, if you get close, it's a ton of different colors. You know, looked at from afar, it looks dark and monochrome. But if you get closer, there's a lot going on. And so I hope that scholars will continue to kind of unpack and look at some of those stories and dig deeper into particular teams or players. And I think that hopefully you'll see and they'll find that there's a lot going on in the decade. And hopefully, you know, over time, that narrative of the Dark Days will be replaced by something that's a little bit less negative towards that period in the NBA.
Well, now we're at the part of the interview where I ask you, what did I miss? Is there something else that you would like to say about the book that I've missed in these questions?
No, not really. I'm very excited. I was very excited to write the book. It was so much fun to research and write. And, you know, every time that I go on a podcast or I'm interviewed, I always think of the all the different kind of stories and narratives. And I love hearing what people who've read the book take away from it. And, you know, it's funny. I've talked to fans of a lot of different teams, and they all seem to really like particular parts of the book better than others. And they want to talk about how their team kind of developed in the 1970s. And so, yeah, it's fun. I think you can read the book as a basketball fan. Obviously, you'll enjoy it. I think as just a fan of history of the end, you know, history of the 1970s. I know, for example, that a lot of my interest in writing about the decade came from a baseball book on the 70s. And so I think that you don't have to be a fan of basketball per se to really take a lot away and see how exciting basketball is in a decade. So no particular things kind of stand out, but I think taken as a whole, it's really an exciting story, and I hope people have as much fun reading it as I did writing it.
Well, which baseball book was it that inspired you there?
So that was Dan Epstein's Big Hair and Plastic Grass. And in many ways, I tried to pattern my book kind of on his style, where he's looking at it chronologically, but also kind of trying to find this big picture narrative of how the game is influencing culture and vice versa. And so, yeah, that was a big influence in my writing for sure.
So, I mean, readers could actually, if they're just interested in, for example, in the section on the Washington Bullets, they could just turn to that chapter because of the way you have it structured year by year. Or if they're big Lakers Knicks fans, you know, they can go back to those, revisit those early rivalries. So it's very, very structured. And of course, the statistics at the end and the standings are very helpful for the reader as well. Because, you know, there are a couple of things that I didn't remember until I looked at it again. I went, oh, okay, they swept that series, you know.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that that's something as well that I was really interested in including, because I love basketballreference.com, but I don't want to leave it open when I'm trying to read a book. And so I think it's helpful to be able to flip to the back of the chapter and look, oh, okay, this is how the Cleveland Cavaliers finished this year. Or, well, why did Boston have home court in that playoffs? And it's a pretty easy, quick reference. And like you said, I think that it's fun to be able just to go to a part of the story you really like. Again, as an Indiana Pacers fan, if I was reading this book just as a Pacers fan, I might flip ahead to the merger in 1976 and just read about how the Pacers fared. Spoiler alert, they didn't do well, but I think that there's the way that it's set up is intentional in that way that you can kind of pick around, you can kind of jump around and still enjoy the overall story.
And looking at the teams, I mean, can you talk about the Lakers, their 33 wins in a row, and then the 76ers that 9-73 season. I mean, that's talking about both extremes.
Sure. Yeah. The 1972 or 71-72 Lakers, of course, have this phenomenal 33 game winning streak. And to me, maybe the most interesting part of that streak is how it starts. And it starts in many ways after the retirement of Elgin Baylor in 1971. And it ends at the hands of the Milwaukee Bucks in 1972 in what might have been the most anticipated regular season game of the decade. You know, there was so much attention being paid to this miraculous historic streak. And then, you know, the Bucks, who were really the arch nemesis of the Lakers at the time, managed to put an end to the streak. So that's fascinating. And then, of course, the next year, the Philadelphia 76ers set a record for ineptitude and only win 9 games in a season. So, you know, you talk about a league of parity, yet in back-to-back seasons, you have teams winning basically 60 games difference, the best in 72 and the worst in 73. So not quite as parity driven, I think, as the narrative usually suggests.
What I also found interesting was that they did the NBA draft over the phone and ran up these large phone bills. It's nothing like it is today.
Oh yeah. The draft is significantly different. And in fact, just, you know, even the way that teams kind of looked at the draft is very different. So you see in the 70s in the NBA, first round draft picks getting thrown around. Of course, there's no protection on the draft picks or anything like that. It's actually how Pete Maravich ends up in Atlanta. Atlanta had a good team and made a midseason trade that ended up netting them the number 3 overall pick. And so while there was a lot of attention paid to the draft when a superstar collegiate player would come out, a Lou Alcindor, a David Thompson, a Bill Walton, the other years, it was kind of an afterthought. It was just something that people did to mark time. They scouted, but the scouting wasn't nearly to the extent it is today. And of course, the draft itself was not the, you know, the extravaganza that it is on television. And as you noted, it was fun to see, you know, they would conduct these conference calls where literally the commissioner would just tell the next team, you know, Phoenix Suns, you're on the clock. And sometime in the next 3 or 4 minutes, the Suns person would tell them who they chose. And the seriousness with which people take the draft now wasn't there in the 1970s.
Well, this has been a very interesting interview for me, and you know, we know your time is very valuable. This is we've been speaking with Dr. Adam J. Cribley, who's author of the book Tall Tales and Short Shorts, Dr. J, Pistol Pete, and the Birth of the Modern NBA. So what's your next project going to be? Have you started anything, or do you have anything in mind?
Yeah, I actually have. I'm fascinated still by the NBA in this era. And one of the stories that really kind of jumped out at me and I wanted to learn more about was late in the 1970s, there's also this issue of the superstar players and the best teams in the league are located in places like Washington, D.C., Seattle, Washington, Denver, Colorado, you know, the major markets, New York, Boston, L.A., Chicago. Their teams are pretty bad by and large at that period. And especially the story of the Knicks jumped out at me. And so the next project is actually going to look at the late 70s, early 80s Knicks and looking at it in terms of both what's going on in New York City at the time. It's a fascinating time in New York City, kind of the rise of hip hop, of punk music, and all kinds of issues going on in the city. And then the Knicks team, who are terrible for most of that period until early in the 80s when Bernard King arrives, and then, of course, Patrick Ewing in 1985. So one different thing about that project is I'm interviewing former players about it. So it'll have a little bit different take than Tall Tales and Short Shorts, but we'll kind of move the story forward a little bit, at least for me.
Definitely. Well, Adam, we really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Bob. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to the New Books in Sports podcast, and I'm Bob D'Angelo, and thank you for joining us tonight. Until next time, remember that the game is what matters. We'll talk to you next time.